Okay, there's a new homework today. It'll be due next Wednesday. We have no days off over this Thanksgiving holiday since we're Monday and Wednesday class. And I have your last homework for those of you who didn't pick it up yet up front. So I'd like to go over a little bit of the last few minutes that I did in kind of a rushed way last time on gene amplification as one way to get high-level protein production in mammalian cells for the production of therapeutic proteins. And I think we probably discussed enough about the DHFR system, which is used in CHO cells, where you select for a marginal resistance to the drug methotrexate. The cells don't respond. The cells have in their population pre-existing, it's thought, at some frequency. Individual cells that have a higher level of the number of DHFR genes, probably by a factor of two, and you can select those out by putting in just enough methotrexate to kill the unamplified cells. So although this is only a partial list of the number of genes that have been successfully gene amplified, selected this way. Selected for gene amplification. The two most widely used, as far as I know, the only ones used, are the diiodofolate reductase and the glutamine synthetase. And we didn't talk, I think, enough about the glutamine synthetase, which is a popular system. The glutamine synthetase system is used in two kinds of cells, CHO cells, again, which have glutamine synthetase genes, so they're not negative for it, and in the NS0 cells, which are attractive because of their natural differentiated state for secreting antibodies, having come from a myeloma, which is a tumor of the plasma cells, which naturally secrete the immunoglobulins. So in the NS0 cells, since there's they make no endogenous, the zero means they were an NS, probably non-synthesizing. They're variants that, for some reason, unknown reason, they have shut off their own endogenous immunoglobulin genes. So they're not making any background of any other kind of antibody. And they naturally, again, for an unknown reason, lack glutamine synthetase. They're not producing it. So you can put in a plasmid that has a glutamine synthetase minigene, a cDNA-based gene that's expressed in mammalian cells. It brings in the enzyme which catalyzes this reaction, which takes glutamic acid, which is made by almost all cells via the Krebs cycle. ATP and ammonia. There's ammonium ions in the medium. There's ammonium sulfate. And tacks on that ammonium ion to form glutamine from glutamate. So it makes the amide from the carboxylic acid. So on the same vector, usually, you have two genes. Since if you're making immunoglobulins, immunoglobulins are made up of a heavy chain and light chain. It's a tetramer, as we'll see in detail in a minute. So it's a little more complicated. And then you simply grow them and put them in glutamine-free medium, and only the cells which receive the glutamine synthetase minigene on the plasmid will grow. In NS0 cells, you can then select for increased levels of the glutamine synthetase and therefore also the fellow traveling heavy and light chain immunoglobulin genes by treating the cells with a strong inhibitor of glutamine synthetase, which is methionine sulfoxamine. For now, what I'm told, although there are a couple of papers in the literature that call this gene amplification, I'm told by my friends in the biotech industry that, in fact, the NS0 cells do not amplify the gene, but you can select subpopulations among many transfectants that are producing at a high level, and therefore you can get the high producers for whatever reason. Maybe they're in a a very good chromosomal location for gene expression. So you can select those out now using the inhibitor. And usually you just go through one round, unlike the gene amplification, which takes many rounds, one round, and you get a high level. And sometimes this level is as high as the level you get after going through the gene amplification. So in that sense, it seems like a better system. However, it is a proprietary system, so it does cost you money to do this, I assume. So Bebington, if you want to learn more about this, I didn't pull out specific references, but if you Google or PubMed on Bebington and glutamine synthetase, you'll get a bunch of papers that describe this in more detail. This license is, this proprietary rights are now with Lonza, who bought the smaller biotech company that founded by Bebington. Now, in CHO cells, they already have glutamine synthetase, but they will do gene amplification. So you can get around this endogenous level and select those cells that received, that definitely received the glutamine synthetase mini gene and your favorite genes along with it, by treating the cells right from the start with a low level of methionine sulfoxamine in the inhibitor. This titrates out the endogenous level of, so you put just enough so that the cells can't grow with their endogenous level of glutamine synthetase. And now the cells coming, the increased levels of transfectants that are making the glutamine synthetase as specified by the exogenous gene in the plasmid will be selected for. And then you can go through increased levels of just as with DHFR methotrexate, you can go with increased levels of the inhibitor gradually and get many glutamine synthetase genes. So both systems are in use with glutamine synthetase. And I don't know if I showed this picture before. This is not a picture of the NS0 cells. I couldn't find that, but they're supposed to look very similar to plasma cells, which are the terminally differentiated cells that secrete immunoglobulins. And you see they're just chock full of endoplasmic reticulum making the secreted protein. So there's two ways you can go through the amplification process, or actually any transfection that's going to bring in a selective marker and also the marker, the plasmid carrying the genes for the protein you want to produce. Most companies are very conservative and they put it all in one plasmid, but it's not really necessary since during transfection by almost every method, I'm not sure about the viral methods, but any method using DNA, the DNA tends to go in 90% or more cases in the same location. So if you're going to do gene amplification, you will, and you generally amplify very large regions. So you'll amplify both your selective marker and your accompanying favorite gene together, even if they come in on separate plasmids. And it affords you the another card to play, which is you can use a high ratio of your favorite gene to the selective marker. 5 times is what recommended in one of the protocols that's published, but I don't see why you couldn't use 1,000 times. As long as you're able to select a few transfectants, you can put a small amount of your selective marker. Many times you don't have the details of how the companies are actually doing it. It's not something they advertise. And this is what I finished off with, was just the protocol we use in our own lab for amplifying the DHFR gene. We like to spread out, to go as quickly as possible. We just don't settle on one concentration at each step, but try a bunch of concentrations and then take the population of cells that has enough members, maybe a dozen, at the highest concentration that we use to go on to the next steps. So a student in my lab has just finished a 6-month course of DHFR amplification. He's got at least 100 copies of the gene. So although the original proteins that were produced using mammalian cells were mostly protein hormones like insulin or signal molecules like interferon, neupogen, which is, stimulates white blood cell growth, or even anti-inflammatories like Enbrel, which is not exactly an antibody. It's a receptor for 2 necrosis factor, which is a protein that's used in inflammation. I see in the New York Times today that the patent's about to run out, but they're going to get another 17 years, I think, Amgen is. And then, by far today, most of the activity is on monoclonal antibodies. Although, as we see, there's still a lot of activity in trying to isolate new proteins that will do the job of monoclonal antibodies without actually being monoclonal antibodies. And it's a big business. So these are billion-dollar gross revenue items. So if you want to be economical about your production, you want to use methods and use, first of all, you want to use methods that will give you highest production. So you need pipes and tubing and computers, hardware to control the growth of these cells. And there's been a lot of advances in the last 10 years on optimizing the conditions for getting maximum secretion of your recombinant protein. You start with pilot studies in the laboratory, then you have like 10 or 50 liter runs. And finally, if you're going to be really in big production, you can have a 10,000 liter reactors that control the oxygen tension, the control of pH continuously, monitoring it and controlling it. Everything has to be sterile. It's a big deal. A company I talked to said it's about $100 million investment to build one of these reactors. First of all, you have to build a building around it. So and there's been a lot of progress on that to maximize secretion and harvesting and all that. But from the point of view of biology, there's a number of things you can do. So, published only as far as I can see in an IDEC patent. IDEC merged with Biogen about, I don't know, 10 years ago. And here the idea was to put your favorite gene. If you're going to be cloning many genes for different products, if you always put it in the same place, then you wouldn't have this problem. And it's a good place, let's say, for production. Then you wouldn't have this problem of always selecting the high producers from among low producers. And so what Ref argued was that even though homologous recombination, and this was in CHO cells, I believe, is very low. You have lots of cells. If you have a good selective method for the homologous recombination, then at least you can always go into the same place and have this kind of reproducibility. So what he did was he put first the DHFR gene, half the DHFR gene using neomycin or some drug resistance marker in, half the DHFR gene into the background of DHFR minus cells, and then look for some good characteristics among those of a clone that was in a good place, I guess, for producing maybe the neomycin resistance protein, and then using his favorite protein attached to the other half of the DHFR gene. So these cells were still DHFR minus because they only had half the mini gene, and some decent amount of homologous of DNA that's homologous to what he put in the first place. Right? So that although the frequency might be only 1 in 10 million instead of 1 in 1,000 for homologous recombination compared to illegitimate recombination, the only ones that will grow in a medium lacking purines are the ones that have reconstituted the DHFR gene. It's had a perfect homologous recombination, put these two together right in an intron, and now they're making DHFR, and you can select for it. And it's a very clean, powerful selection. The cells without purines just die completely. So he would get a few colonies out of just a few very large dishes. So that's one nice technique. Mitsubishi later elaborated on this a little more in the same way, but incorporated a LOX site. So that's a site-specific recombination substrate for the Cre recombinase. So they could bring the Cre recombinase, transiently express it, that's a bacterial recombinase, and having also LOX sites, and the two LOX sites then, the two types of LOX sites will recombine. So you don't have to get 1/10^7. It's more like 1/10^5. So still not fantastic, but it's 100 times easier. You get 100 times more colonies. Right? And always go into the same place.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What was that last sentence you said about why you don't have to use this?
Because the LOX sites promotes recombination at the LOX site. So I hesitate to use the word homologous recombination. I don't want to confuse it with general homologous recombination, where you just have a sequence that will recombine, find its homolog somewhere in the genome. Here it still has to find that LOX site. But once it does, then it tends to go in there. So the cell won't do that, but so you have to supply it with the recombinase that is specific for recombining LOX sites. You have the two types of LOX sites. The LOX sites that's sort of the target, and the LOX site that's the bullet. And they're called ATTP attachment, ATTP or ATTB. And those two will combine, then they make something else. So you can try to, probably not the best order, the most obvious thing is to use a great promoter. And the CMV is a great promoter, but maybe it's not the best. It's, you know, people sort of settled in on it. And there are patents for eukaryotic initiation factor alpha, which is one of the proteins that is necessary to initiate translation, all these EIF proteins. That is a very strong promoter. And a company patented that one and built itself up, now taken over by somebody else. The actin promoter is strong. Or you might think of, and there's not that much work done on this, in E. coli, this biotechnology guy at MIT, quite famous, Stephanopoulos, he is making artificial promoters and just selecting for them. And you could imagine maybe there's room for some improvement on mammalian promoters using this kind of genetic selection and survey. The control of chromatin structure is also something that can be done more rationally nowadays, as you can put in sequences that will attract chromatin remodeling, that are known to bind chromatin remodeling proteins, those that acetylate the lysines, and that makes the histones bind less strongly because the positive charge is taken away when it's acetylated on the amino group, becomes a amide group. And acetylated histones are associated with more open chromatin structure, which makes it easier for polymerase to get through. At least that's the rationale. and even other chromatin remodeling proteins that will tend to demethylate the histones, which is also in the direction of opening up chromatin. Insulator sequences have been identified, some that are widely used in the genome, tens of thousands of these, that help prevent the chromatin structure of one gene. Let's say it's a very silent area of heterochromatin, which is like near the centromere or near the telomeres, or or just natural patches of heterochromatin, and large regions that are kept silent. And it's known that this effect spreads, and the insulators stop this spreading. So you could build those around your favorite genes to keep them active. And I think these are all the ones I could think of in terms of production. What hasn't been used too much, and we have a proposal in for this actually, is to focus on post-transcriptional modifications. And so for instance, in the natural world, if you want to make a lot of protein, so you want to make a lot of casein in your mammary gland, or you want to make a lot of albumin in your liver, and may even be true, well, it's true for also hemoglobin and red blood cells. One thing you do in all those three cases is you stabilize your messenger RNA. You make a form of messenger RNA that's more stable. And or you alter the factors in the cell that are leading to the degradation. This is not too well understood area. But what's clear is that the messenger RNA gets more stabilized. And for every factor of two that you increase the half-life of your messenger RNA, your product's going to go up by a factor of two. It's just as good as getting a promoter that works twice as well. So so that's another factor. Or control of translation. Nobody's done anything on this, hardly anything. Finally, not finally, but next to the last, let's consider genetically manipulating the cell so that it doesn't go into apoptosis. You can imagine these cells in these 10,000 liter vessels. You want to grow them up, and you can grow them up to 10 million cells per milliliter, which is more than you get in the laboratory. But then they're cranking out your protein, and you want to, the usual ways, you keep them there cranking it out, and you wait, and you wait, and you wait until they're, and the cells aren't growing anymore. But so the cells under this condition could go into apoptosis and die, and then they're not cranking anymore. So if you have cells that are resistant to apoptosis and could just stay alive, they don't have to divide, but stay alive and stay metabolically active, then that would also give you a better yield. And there's some work going on in those areas. And finally, if you're talking about, most secreted proteins are glycosylated as one of their post-translational modifications. That's important. And monoclonal antibodies in particular are glycosylated in important ways. The glycosylation tends to aid in the function of the antibody in some cases, and in some cases it's, and more generally it aids in its half-life in the serum, and so it can be made more effective. And these are generally not having to do with the binding ability of the antibody, which is part of the protein that's not glycosylated, but this is on sort of the constant region, but has to do with the function, and the different antibodies have different functions. And so if you can manipulate the glycosylation pattern, and we'll talk about that in some detail in lectures to come, and that's another way not to get more production, but to get higher quality protein. So here's a comparison of 1990 versus 2004, so that was 14 years, and now it's up to about double this, or maybe more. Who's got the record for a number of grams per liter of protein you can produce? That's about 5.5 now, as in 2005. And Lonza, which is a contract manufacturer, you give them your gene, your plasmid, they'll make the protein for you at a price, as well as a cell development and a medium seller. And it's a big company. So this is showing that you get how your cells go up here. The cells are here in blue. And this is time, you know, it goes out to 576 hours, right? So that's, the last point here is 23 days. So the culture is growing for a long time. The cells grow up, and after a few days, they reach sort of a plateau. But during this plateau phase, they're cranking out this purple spots, which are the grams of antibody per liter. You see here they're going up to 5.5. So keeping the cells alive for a long time, growing them up to high density to begin with, which is about 10 million per milliliter, and finally getting a higher output per cell by those biological manipulations. So it's efficient. Here's a picture of a 20,000 liter fermenter in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I think the biggest that's around is 30,000. But popular is around 10,000. And you can see it's got this building. So let's do a little back of the envelope calculation here on the math here. In the REF patent, they said by optimizing the position where you put your gene, you can get 55 picograms of product, I believe that was an immunoglobulin, per cell per day. So that's one way of expressing it. The other way is the way we saw in the previous slide. How many grams per liter of the stuff can you get? This, in a way, is a nicer kind of metric because it sort of tells you what each cell is doing. So if I take this number and I take 10 to the 7th per ml, so that's 10 to the 10th cells per liter, then if we multiply 55 times 10 to the minus 12, because it's picograms, per cell per day times 10 to the 7 cells per liter, we get about 0.55 grams per liter per day. And if you could figure about 20 days, then that's 11 grams calculated. So Lonza just reported 5 grams. So they're really in the same ballpark. That is, these two numbers of the two different companies expressing the best they could get are about the same. If you had the biggest reactor there is at 30,000 liters, then if you're making it at 5 grams per liter, then you could make 150 kilograms in one run, which is going to be 20 days, or let's say 1 month. Right? If you just keep doing this every month of the year, you wash it out, you sterilize it, you start again, you're going to make 150 times 12 months, 1,800 kilograms, which is 2 tons of immunoglobulin. I don't know if there's a market for two tons, but you do need a lot of it. I found a monoclonal antibody dose for a particular application being about 0.5 gram per shot into a person. So this 2 tons will give you then 3.6 million doses in this reactor in 1 year. Often, a person gets treated every couple of months. It's being treated for cancer, it's being treated for inflammation. So you come into the hospital, you get this infusion of 0.5 gram. So let's say you have 6 doses per year. So then you could treat 600,000 patients per year with one reactor running for 1 year. Now, $15,000 per year is really cheap. Mostly you hear about $100,000 a year for these kinds of treatments. But even at $15,000 a year, because some of that money goes to the hospital, right? So that's $9 billion. So if it costs you $100 million to build this building with the reactor, it's well worth it. Of course, that's not all profit, but a lot of it is. Well, you have to fund the research to find the new drugs, right? What are these monoclonal antibodies then? I spent way more time than I expected on that. So antibodies are immunoglobulins. They're tetramers, 2 heavy chains, 2 light chains. A monoclonal antibody will bind to a single site on the antigen or epitope. We have a lot of these terms. Many of you know this, but I'm trying to put us all at least on the same on the same page here. They're produced by certain white blood cells derived from these B lymphocytes. And they can be used therapeutically by, instead of you making the antibody, you get shot up with this antibody and it goes and does its job, either attacking cancer cells or attacking inflammatory cells or attacking bacterial toxins or attacking bacteria when you can't mount a response to them. it's used actually in infections, although not that much. Mostly cancer and inflammation. And as we saw, you can produce a lot of it if you're willing to invest. So these B cells start out in the bone marrow with a common progenitor that produces both the red blood cell, hematopoietic stem cells come out of that, and also the lymphoid stem cells. So these are the white cells, blue here. And the white cells divide between somewhat simplified T cells and B cells and a few other cells. And the B cells go through various stages of differentiation. They become pro-B cells and then pre-B cells. And during all this time, the different stages of cells can be distinguished by surface antigens that appear. And these are taken advantage of in the cell sorter to analyze how many of which kind of stage of differentiation cells you have. Your first immature B cell starts making one kind of immunoglobulin, immunoglobulin M. You start rearranging the chains at the level of DNA to provide the diversity, to help provide the diversity in the number of different kinds of antibodies that will encounter foreign proteins that are giving you trouble. Right? Finally, these mature B cells go out into the circulation, and at the final step, in terms of soluble antibody, you have the plasma cell whose job it is to secrete the immunoglobulin. Many of the other cells, the T cells, and earlier stage B cells, act as at a cellular level. They display the antibody on their surface, and they can go and attack antigen-bearing cells as cells. So you have a cell-mediated immunity, and you have the soluble. And of course, so far, all the therapy we're talking about is focusing on the soluble, because that's what you can manufacture and put in a tube and inject. So each immunocyte, which is a general word for one of these kinds of cells, they synthesize only a single type of immunoglobulin, only one immunoglobulin, one protein with a defined amino acid sequence in each of its chains. But in response to an antigen, when you mount an immune response, you generally have a whole family of B cells and terminally differentiated B cells that are producing different antibodies, maybe to different epitopes, on the original antigen. So you have a whole bunch of separate clones of B cells, each one producing an immunoglobulin with a slightly different target or a very different target epitope, and yet all directed against the same foreign protein that's been sensed. So that the general state of your blood when you're fighting off an infection or cancer is that you have many clones directed towards that. It's called polyclonal. So this is the opposite of these monoclonal antibodies. So I've given you stuff to read about this. I'm just going through it rather briefly. So I'll have a bunch of pictures now, starting with this graphic 15, of the showing this general picture of this Y-shaped molecule, which is the antibody. And it's organized into four chains. So the two light chains are on the outside of these Y arms here, encircled in red. And then the heavy chains are over twice as large and go down to the stem. These ellipses indicate that when the protein folds, it folds into domains, these four domains. So for the light chain, for example, which has only two domains, it has the V domain, which on the light chain would be called VL, and it's got a constant domain. So the variable domain is where the antibody diversity and the antigen binding site is. And it works in concert with a similar heavy chain variable region, which is, again, about the same size up here, but instead of half the molecule, it's only a quarter of the molecule because the heavy chain is so much larger. So the light chain has one constant region. The heavy chain has one, two, three constant regions. And then there's a duplication of all that on the other side of the molecule. But each of these heavy and light variable regions constitute one binding site, so that the antibody itself can bind two antigens, antigenic epitopes. By manipulating the molecule and also conceptualizing it somehow, in some sense, you can divide the molecule into two halves called the FAB fragment, where the AB means antigen binding. So that's the half, that's the arms here. And it's a little ambiguous as to whether they're connected or not, as you'll see. At the junction of the arms with the stem, it's called the hinge region. So that has its own name. And then there's the FC region, which stands originally for the part that was crystallizable after it was cleaved here, and that sort of historical term. So it doesn't stand for constant exactly, although sometimes you'll see that as constant. It's really crystallizable because the constant region extends beyond this. It extends into the arms as well. The two, all four chains are held together by disulfide bonds, and there's also intra-chain disulfide bonds. Here's a kind of a space-filling model that's a more realistic. So you have the heavy chain in blue here, and it's going here around the back of the light chain on the left, or it's in overlapping in front of it on the right. Here are the two pink domains of the of the light chain, the variable on the end and the constant here. And in addition, here is shown the major carbohydrate attachment site, which is in the stem in the FC portion. In the laboratory, you can fragment by limited digestion with proteolytic enzymes. So pepsin will give you the FC fragment as a dimer, still held together because it cuts below the disulfides that are connecting these two heavy chains, and so you get all four chains making up the two arms of the Y, as well as the FC fragment below it, not pictured. But if you digest with papain, which is a different proteolytic enzyme, then that cuts instead of below, it cuts above the disulfide, so the FC fragment comes out as a dimer instead of monomers here, and the two arms come out as two separate FAB fragments. You can also treat with mercaptoethanol, which reduces the disulfide bonds, and then with a little more help can dissociate the chains into the individual heavy and light chains. So when you read papers on antibodies, you sort of have to know this kind of stuff to figure out what's going on. Now, yet another picture that's showing the disulfides as well as the carbohydrates. So it's got everything, I guess, in there. It's sort of a summary. The only thing it adds here is the information that these variable regions also fall into families. So they're not just like one variable region with lots of variation, but rather you can see there's a family which is called mu, which has a lot of similarity one to another in the family, and yet variation within that family. And likewise, gamma, alpha, delta, or epsilon. So you have five different families of heavy chain variable regions and two different families of light chain variable regions, kappa or lambda. So it gets quite complicated. Another term you'll see is a CDR, which is the complementarity determining region. That is the antigen binding region up here between the two V regions. And then even within this variable region, there's parts of it that are variable a little bit, and others that are highly variable, where you see lots of different amino acids being put in. So that's called the hypervariable region. These different classes of antibodies, depending on what kind of heavy chain or light chain they have, but mostly the heavy chain, have different functions. So, the function, different functions are mostly determined by the constant regions. So it turns out the constant regions also fall into families. So there's about, six or more families of different constant regions, which also get switched on. But they don't have all this variation within them, amino acid changes. It's just you either use one type of constant region or another type of constant region. And we'll see that in a minute. And they have these different functions. So one kind of antibody will do something like surround the bacteria and sort of dissolve it, attack its membranes. Others will activate complement. I'll go over this in a little more detail in a minute. So activating proteases, which are in our bloodstream in a dormant way, and activate them so that they help destroy the cell that they're that the antibody is binding to. And you have cell-mediated toxicity, where these where the antibody binds to a cell and then exposes this its own particular FC fragment, and that FC fragment is recognized by another cell, a natural killer cell, which goes and attaches to the target cell and kills it, as we'll see in a minute. And even antibodies that will transport your antigen from one side of an epithelial layer to another, like in the gut or in the lungs. Then the structures get more complicated. You can have these polymeric structures. So IgM is made up not of just this single Y-shaped, but five of these, a pentamer of Y-shaped antibody molecules, all connected by yet more disulfide bonds, not this time between the tetramers, to make a pentamer of tetramers. And that's shown in sort of somewhat more detail here, as well as one helping small protein chain that's related to the antibody genes. And even a secreted protein like IgA can form dimers of the pentamers. Right? So each has its own characteristic composition. So the IgA, for example, has either an alpha 1 or an alpha 2 type of a family of variable region. The IgE has no particular subclasses, just has this epsilon group. And the IgG, which is the one we think of most as the predominant secretory immunoglobulin, the soluble one, has this gamma type, but even within the gamma, there are subfamilies, four different subfamilies. So, the variability is brought about at one level by choosing different variable regions to put in that are coded for, that are part of your genome. You're born with them. And certain variable regions are chosen, recombine in the DNA as the B cell matures and gets connected to the constant region and then gets turned on as a newly sort of composed gene. We'll see that. And that works through specific recombination signals and specific recombinases that work in the immune system to provide this. In the light chain, you have variable regions, then you have a small connecting region called the J region. I think there's five of those, but there's many variable regions, and then they're connected to one constant region for a particular kind of antibody, and then the constant region will later switch for different functions. The heavy chain has, in addition to the V and J, a D region, which is interposed between V, D, and J. So you get recombinations that produce a VDJ piece, which is all of this is just coded for. You're born with it. But that particular combination of like V number 23, D number 9, and J number 3 will give you a particular amino acid sequence. Right? So here's a hard slide, number 22. If we look at the top, you see the maturation of a light chain. So here's 76 different V kappas. And there's the V lambdas, which is yet another kind of that. But among the V kappas, there's 76 V kappa regions. any one of which then can be used to connect to one of the five J regions and then one constant region to form then this VJ region. And then actually out at the left here, there's a constant leader region which has the secretory signals that signal this protein to be transferred to the lumen of the endoplasmic reticulum and eventually secreted from the cell. So that's necessary for all of these. And then there's this constant region out here. This is only one constant region because this is the light chain. So you have a VJ. Now notice importantly, in addition to this rearrangement giving you this diversity, it's still not nearly the diversity that is seen in the different amino acid sequences and the repertoire of antibodies you have. And that's because there is a more random process that doesn't depend on what you're born with, but depends on how you operate on that causing additional mutations. There's a hypermutation mechanism that changes the DNA in any individual clone of maturing B cells so that each one is producing essentially a unique antibody. And then many of these may be no good for anything. But if it is good for something and it's there circulating, you're walking around with tens of millions of these, maybe more, then when you do get an infection, the cell that has, the cells are now quiescent, circulating, the cell that has, by chance, made an antibody that's good against Staph aureus infection will be selected for if you should be unfortunate to get such an infection. When it binds that cell, because this antibody is on its surface, it stimulates it to divide, and you get a whole bunch of those cells. So these are, again, picked out. With the heavy chains, it's the same thing, except more complicated. Here's 95 heavy chain variable regions to pick from, 30 different D regions over here, again, 5 J regions, and then you have these different constant regions, which we'll talk about in a minute, and then the leader signal as well. So you end up with the leader, the VDJ, all connected, and then 3 constant regions, and then a hinge region as well. So after all this, and you have generated your very variable, very varied variable region through the various combinations of VDJs and the hypermutation that takes place subsequently, you go through a maturation process, or a process that picks out different constant regions to tack onto this according to what stage of differentiation the B cell is and what that antibody is going to be used for. So this is yet a different recombination system called the switch recombination, constant switch recombination system, class switch recombination system. And there's these specific sequences in here, and again a recombinase that will then snip out. Let's say you want to make this one, IgE, which requires a constant epsilon factor, which is way out here, downstream. These are all on single chromosomes, right, in one region, but over millions of bases. So if you have a recombination between this left-hand one and the one that's just in front of this CE, then you recombine here, this circle gets snipped out and is destroyed. It doesn't replicate. And you're left with a slightly smaller chromosome and the VDJ connected to the epsilon. And so you can make that. Down here. Then in addition to that, you have splicing that takes place. This is just the primary transcript. You have splicing to put these things together in a final functional messenger RNA. So this kind of, it's called isotypes switching, can take place. Like on the right here, you've gone and taken a lot of things out. On the left, you've taken only 2 things out and gone down to a gamma here. But it doesn't have to be a complete commitment, because you can take these 2 things out, make a gamma, and then that guy can later take out the first gamma and go to something further downstream. So you can do it in one fell swoop, or you can do it in stages. So this Janeway book, which is about 10 years old, is available for searching. You can't browse it, but searching on the PubMed site. It's a nice source of information to looking up various aspects of the immune system. Now, in addition to all that class switching, you also can have alternative splicing, which can give you different kinds of antibody classes. So you might have a pre-mRNA that's gone through all of its DNA recombinations. It still looks like this with a C mu and then a C delta further downstream. And you can produce this as a long pre-mRNA. It has a poly A site here. So then you would just make the C mu, but that doesn't seem quite right to me now. So if this is the RNA, it doesn't matter where the poly A site is, because that poly A site defines the end of the mRNA. So in this case, you've made the splice here, and so you make this light blue guy with the proximal exons. But you could also splice this initial transcript skirting over the poly A site and going directly to this new set of exons further downstream and make IgD instead of IgM. Both have different, both have different functions. A system that's studied very much from the point of view of trying to figure out how alternative splicing works is the difference for IgM. IgM has two forms, one which is actually secreted IgM, and another form which is stuck to the membrane. And in this case, again, RNA splicing is different. If you just splice all of these together, you get this small one. But if you skip this blue part, which has the poly A site, you can have the same front half, but then avoid that poly A site and pick up two additional exons further downstream. And that part of the protein now will code for membrane anchoring sequence, which makes it membrane type IgM. So just about every trick in the book is used to make these antibodies. And they're quite varied. So this is just a complicated table, or just a big table, but just to show you that one thing I was impressed by. Look at the levels, the serum level, simply. How much do you have? I need new batteries. So you go from a value of 9 down to a value of 10 to the minus 5th, so that not all the antibodies are being used in the same amount. So I don't know how that is controlled. Going from bad to worse here. Let me try some more. Maybe I have a loose connection in this laser. I'll be able to use my fingers, I suppose. If I have to. Make sure I have this right. Plus. And plus. There we go. Some antibodies will cross the placental barrier, for example, very well. Others will not. And all of this is due to the you know, the constant different constant regions. The half-life would be a tenfold difference of how fast they're cleared from the serum. And they're defined, as I say, by which heavy chain they have. So this is more detail on some of their functions. Antibodies displayed on a class of white cells called macrophages can recognize bacteria that are coated with that with antibody molecules and just ingest them and destroy them inside. These are very large mobile cells. Complement proteins, by attacking the cell proteins in the cell membrane, make holes and thereby kill the cells. And complement can be activated by antibodies that have a particular Fc region when they're bound to, say, these bacteria. And others can move complexes away from places by transferring them to the other side of epithelial membranes. And then finally, this rather important class of ADCC, cell-mediated cytotoxicity, I'll spend a little more time on. So here the antibody binds to, let's say, a cell, a bacterial cell, or let's say a cancer cell, and it binds with its V regions, and so what's sticking out is the Fc region. So this is just a cartoon of the various first three ways. Let's go directly to this last aspect of this cartoon. Now there's a natural killer cell, which is part of the immune repertoire, which has specifically on its receptor, on its surface, the Fc receptor. So that's in green here. So the Fc receptor recognizes the Fc part of the molecule, and so this whole cell now will bind the target cell. And once it binds to two or more of these Fcs, and you get kind of a dimerization of the receptor in the natural killer cell, that signals the natural killer cell to secrete these toxic products, which are, again, are two types. One is a protein that punches holes in the membrane. I don't know how the natural killer cell doesn't kill itself this way. Maybe it does. And the other are proteolytic enzymes that go in and through these holes get into the target cell and initiate apoptosis. So in apoptosis, one of the steps is proteolytic activation of nucleases and other proteases. There's a cascade of proteases, which themselves, to be activated, have to be cleaved. And these enzymes go in, and at that level, pretty far down on the apoptotic pathway, these are like caspases, they get activated, and the cell dies by taking advantage of its own propensity to undergo programmed cell death. Now here's, and all that is here. And here's Genentech's version of this from one of their ADCC acting antibodies. And there's the Fc, there's the receptor, here's the natural killer cell. These are these little proteases and perforins at work. I think I will skip these since I actually talked about this already, about the clones of cells and the polyclonal nature of the natural response. I just might add that during this maturation of these clones of cells, each of which is producing a particular antibody against your antigen, there's this stimulation of growth. But the stimulation of growth doesn't just change this unstimulated cell into a stimulated cell that completely differentiates, but rather it divides itself between some cells that are only partially differentiated, but have the memory of this antigen-antibody interaction, as well as these cells that are going to go on and do their jobs, either as the various ways that were outlined, including simply binding to the antibody and secreting the antibody. There are these memory cells that are not secreting it, but there's a population that is maintained, which is larger than the population that you started out with, but is being held back. So that if you get a second exposure, then all these cells that were waiting can now be induced to differentiate and give this better response. So that's how you have vaccinations work, is that you have all these memory cells which you keep for the rest of your life, or at least many years, that are able to mount a quick response to an antigen that you were exposed to previously. Our picture again. So all this explains polyclonals. Well, you see the polyclonals are made up of populations of monoclonals. So how do you get these antibodies? So you can't very well take antibodies from a rabbit that's been immunized against Staph aureus and inject it into you, or maybe you could, but that doesn't work so well. So in the late 70s, Kohler and Milstein, two immunologists, figured that they have these myeloma cells that are producing this particular antibody from the tumor it was producing. And you can grow them in culture and you can make plenty of antibody. But this antibody is useless. It's not against anything particular. On the other hand, you can inject a mouse with Staph aureus and it will mount a response to the Staph aureus. And you have this mouse cell that's producing, among its millions of different antibody-producing molecules, quite a few that are producing anti-Staph. Right? So there's an antibody there. If only they could use it, it would be nice to study it and maybe even use it therapeutically. But it's being produced in the mouse, and you could get it produced in the mouse because you're in charge of what you inject into that mouse and look for. And you could even separate those cells that are producing that antibody using a cell sorter or something like that. But those cells don't grow in culture. They're terminally differentiated. So here you have a cell that grows forever, this myeloma cell. In culture, it's from this tumor, it's an established cell line. And here's this other cell is doing the thing you want. So about this time, all this cell fusion work was going on. They said, well, why not take this laboratory strain of mouse myeloma cells and fuse it to the total spleen population of a mouse that's been immunized against Staph aureus. Add polyethylene glycol, you get these heterokaryons, and then among the heterokaryons you select for, because we want something that's going to grow forever, you select for hybrid cells that have the nuclei fused, as we talked about. And we can do this because we can select against both parents, because first of all, the spleen cells don't grow in culture. They're terminally differentiated, these white cells in the spleen. Right? So they're not going to grow. The myeloma cells will isolate a mutant that can't grow under a certain kind of medium. And what they isolated, or actually I think they found, as had been previously isolated, was an HPRT minus mutant that could not salvage hypoxanthine as a purine source if its de novo pathway was blocked. And you can easily block that de novo pathway, as we learned, with methotrexate, then called amifampridine. So if you treat the cell with amifampridine, it's going to require purines, like hypoxanthine, and a source of thymidine, as well as glycine. Glycine was always present. So whereas wild-type myeloma cells will grow in this hypoxanthine, amifampridine, thymidine medium, because it's got the, can it salvage the hypoxanthine and the thymidine to get over the block by methotrexate, the HPRT minus variant of that can't salvage hypoxanthine. And since it can't make its own purines because of methotrexate, it will die. Right? The spleen cells have perfectly good gene for HPRT. So that will contribute to the hybrid. The myeloma will contribute its complex phenotype of being able to grow forever in culture. And that the only thing that will grow after such a cell fusion in a medium with hypoxanthine, amifampridine, and thymidine, or HAT medium, will be the hybrid. So they did this. They cultured it in HAT medium. They selected, and they put all their cells in multi-well, 96-well dishes, and they looked for wells that had little colonies of, it's a little tricky because these myeloma cells don't adhere. They're suspension cells, but they adhere a little bit. And you can see clusters of cells growing, or nothing growing. And those cells that had, those wells that had colonies, then they could just take the supernatant from those and see if it contained an antibody against Staph aureus. So most of them that had the cells, they're making some antibody, but not against Staph aureus. But if they screen a few hundred or a few thousand, and you can do it almost automatic, automated way, you find positive clones. You pick one of those clones, and now you can propagate it either in culture forever, or you can inject it into the peritoneal cavity of a mouse, and it will grow as kind of a tumor, soluble, I mean a suspension of cells there, and you can harvest them from the mouse. The mouse is essentially your incubator. Or you can put it in your own incubator. And now you have, since these all grew from single cells, you have just that spleen cell, presumably a plasma cell, or a late-stage maturation B cell, which is now immortalized. And it's in this big, strange cell called a hybridoma. So the hybridoma, as a word, just means taking an oma cell, a cell that can grow forever in culture, and fusing it to a cell that's terminally differentiated, in this case of the immune system. But so people have made hybridomas from neurons and from liver cells, but the word hybridoma has become synonymous, though, with hybrids of formed from the immune system. And now you have not a polyclonal situation, but a monoclonal situation. And you now can use this as therapy agents. You can, first of all, use it diagnostically. They're very useful. They're just looking for a particular isotope. Look how, in the Rice paper, they used a monoclonal antibody to such good advantage, just specific for that Kringle region so that they could zero in on that particular phenotype and improve their protein that way. So it's used in the laboratory. It's used clinically, diagnostically, and it's also used mostly what we'll consider is therapeutically, even in viral infections. And since those days, which is early 80s then, as this hybridoma synthesis matured, I remember departments were setting up facilities for making monoclonal antibodies, and you could bring your gene in, you bring your antigen in, and come back a month later, and they give you the monoclonal antibody, or they'll give you the hybridoma cells from which you can make your own monoclonal antibody secreted into the medium. And now it's done to a large extent commercially. Now you can use just the plain monoclonal antibody, or you can get fancy and fuse it to other proteins. So, for instance, when you think of that ADCC reaction, here, you have this FC fragment that's going to mediate this natural killer cell association and killing. So you don't necessarily have to have an antibody down here. You could have, for instance, a receptor for some protein that's being produced on this. Anything that will bind tightly, you could just take the FC part and connect it to a protein that has a high affinity for your target cell. You could take your monoclonal antibody and cut off the FC part and use instead, this is building genes this way, right, that have some toxin, like ricin, which, if it gets into the cell, will stop protein synthesis, or calicomycin, which will get in and cause DNA breaks. So you can try and target your molecule. I don't know if you can still call it a monoclonal antibody. It's got its affinity that you selected for and screened for in the production after injecting your mouse and then screening the hybridomas that came from that mouse. It will bind to, say, some particular antigen that's hopefully exclusively made, this is the problem, exclusively made on a cancer cell. And then it will get some fraction of those will get endocytosed into the cell, and it's like this Trojan horse will come in and then do all its damage. Or you can even attach strong radioactive isotopes that are bound by proteins attached to your monoclonal antibody and kill cells that way. Right. So the so-called elusive silver grail or silver holy grail or silver bullet. So some of them sort of work. So further development of these monoclonal antibodies can, once you have your monoclonal antibody, it's not generally that useful per se because the hybridomas don't produce enough of it compared to these NS0 cells or CHL cells. So nowadays you would take the cDNA from those cells, build yourself a mini gene for the light chain, for the heavy chain, from the hybridomas, and then that have already then been screened and characterized, and make your own genes for those antibodies and put them into CHO cells or NS0 cells. And then you can put on your own high expression level promoters and poly A signals, introns, etc. Secondly, you can take those antibodies that are against some virus, say, and you can improve them yourself. You say, well, this mouse didn't do the best job possible. Yeah, it works, but it doesn't have such a great affinity. Let's increase the affinity let's see if we can increase the affinity tenfold, hundredfold, thousandfold. Can we do it? Well, we can use genetics, and we can screen, as we'll see. So you get second and even third generation antibodies in vitro. Now, there is a problem in using these. This came from a mouse, after all. Now, you can make hybridomas from using spleen from other animals, like rabbits and rats. Mouse is still the most popular. And there's maybe some advantages for particular cases for each of those. Maybe they mount a better response against the antigen you're interested in. But if you're going to inject these into people, you're going to have problems. For one thing, if you're going to use this FC guy with this special receptor, the receptor on your natural killer cells is not going to recognize the FC of a rat or a mouse antibody, at least not well. So you really should have a human FC. Well, so you could do that. You could say, when I make my cDNA, since the constant region isn't determining in any way the form of the antigen specificity, I'll use the FC from a human cell, let's say from gamma, from a secreted antibody cell, and just use the variable region from the mouse. And that works, sort of. Also, antibody from a different species doesn't have as good a half-life. And probably most important is that you'll mount yourself a response to this foreign protein, because it's not a human protein. It's recognized as foreign, and you'll start to make antibodies against this monoclonal antibody. And in fact, it could get serious because you give a second treatment, you could really go into an anaphylactic shock because you have such an overblown immune response. But at the least, retreatment is less effective because you've built up antibodies against this monoclonal antibody. So you could just fuse the mouse region. This is so-called chimeric. This was the first generation of solving this problem, was using chimeric. A quarter mouse and three quarters human. The second is to take that strategy even further. Look inside the V region and make changes that as I said, there was a hypervariable region, and then there's kind of like a framework region around this hypervariable region, even within the V region. So you could, with difficulty, but you can do it, engineer, even synthesize the DNA. It's not that long. Synthesize a humanized, a V region that looks more human, except for those key residues, amino acid residues that are defining the antigen binding site, and hope that it still binds the antigen. And you can, the trial and error you find, you can do this. And these are better. These don't mount as much. They have, after all, human C regions and a humanized V region. But finally, you can take a mouse, knock out its own immune system entirely, replace it with the human genes for the 96 heavy chain variable regions, the 72, whatever it was, light chain variable regions, the constant regions. Build a mouse with a human immune system. You could do this. It's been done. So this is the best solution. That mouse responds, it's producing human antibody, not humanized antibody. Of course, it's more expensive. A couple of companies do this. Kieran Beer Company, I'm interested in. Okay, I think we have to stop there, and we'll continue next time. Have a nice holiday. We'll see you on Monday.